Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an effort by the loyal Trump lackey, Senator Lindsey Graham, to pressure Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, to throw out mail-in ballots in the hope of overturning Biden's narrow victory in an intervention Graham disputes, even though a second witness to the call, Gabe Sterling, supports what Raffensperger has made public. Eric Siegel, the Ash Family Chair Professor of Law at Georgia State University, who teaches federal courts and constitutional law and is the author of Originalism as Faith, joins us to discuss the Democrats' chances of winning Georgia's two Senate seats in the January 5th runoff elections for control of the Senate. We will also discuss his latest law articles, Religious Liberty as Religious Supremacy, Why Justice Alito's Federalist Society speech was paranoid and inaccurate, and Goodbye to Originalist Judges. Then we'll look into Trump's plan to pull U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, Iraq, and Somalia, together with his threat to bomb the Iranian nuclear site at Natanz, which appear to have little to do with foreign policy or national security, but instead are spiteful and vindictive acts designed to frustrate Biden and tie his hands in dealing with the region. Clearly, the Taliban have no incentive to negotiate a peace treaty now that U.S. leverage has folded, and Pakistan will again have sway over a terrorist sanctuary and fundamentalist state, while, after the trillion or so the U.S. has invested, China will end up exploiting Afghanistan's mineral riches. Christine Fair, professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service, who was previously a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan, joins us to discuss the worsening mess Trump is handing Biden. Then finally, we'll discuss the reaction at Stanford University to Trump's new medical advisor, Scott Atlas's call for Trump supporters to rise up against Michigan Governor Whitmer, who was recently threatened with kidnapping and murder by pro-Trump militia members. William Gould, a Stanford law professor specializing in labor and discrimination law, joins us to discuss efforts underway by Stanford students to dissociate the university from the Hoover Institution and what many see as a weak response to Atlas's incitement to violence by top university officials.
And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. Which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute.
And joining us now is Eric Siegel, who is the Ash Family Chair Professor of Law at Georgia State University, where he teaches federal courts and constitutional law. He's the author of Originalism as Faith, and he just wrote the law articles Religious Liberty as Religious Supremacy, Why Justice Alito's Federalist Society speech was paranoid and inaccurate, and Goodbye to Originalist Judges. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Siegel.
Thanks, Ian. Always glad to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I obviously want to talk to you about the articles that you've just written. But Georgia is very much at the center of the future. In fact, you could argue the future of whether or not Joe Biden will have a successful presidency, because if the Democrats don't win those two runoff elections in Georgia, which will be voted on January the 5th, we'll have continued gridlock with Mitch McConnell, the Grim Reaper, basically holding up all of Biden's cabinet. He can do that, and all of his appointees, and then, of course, all of the federal judges, as McConnell has done so successfully in stymieing Obama, his list of judges, and Bob stacking the court during the Trump 4 years, which he's also done successfully. So what's the sense in Georgia of whether the Democrats have a chance of winning? They have to actually win both of these seats. So what do you think is the prognosis there?
There are two seats. And I think it's unlikely that most people think it's unlikely Democrats could win both. The seat currently held by Senator Loeffler, who was put in by Governor Kemp as a replacement when our older senator resigned. I think that seat is really in play. She's being challenged by an African-American pastor who is very, very popular, and she's not so popular. The runoff between Ossoff and Perdue is going to be harder for the Democrats, I think.
And why is that, do you think?
Well, he has all the advantages of being an incumbent, you know, for the entire senatorial period. The other thing, I think the Loeffler is just, even by Georgia standards and even by Republican Party standards, she is way out. I think she might be easier to beat. But to be honest, I'm not optimistic either Democrat will win. But having said that, I didn't think the Democrats would go for Biden either. So I consciously self-identify as a progressive. I do work for the state of Georgia. So, I have to be a little bit careful in what I say. But I think most people down here probably would take a split at this point if it was offered to the Democrats. I think it's unlikely they'll win both. But this is an unlikely year. So who knows?
Well, what's happening now, though, is quite interesting in the sense that you have the Georgia Secretary of State, who is actually being a real mensch, and he's being a patriot, and he's standing up for what is right, and he's being pressured by all kinds of senior Republicans, including Senator Lindsey Graham, who today tried to weasel his way out of saying that he didn't say what he said to Raffensperger. But, of course, the other person listening in, Gabe Sterling, Raffensperger's deputy, heard the same conversation and verifies that Lindsey Graham did indeed pressure them to toss out a bunch of ballots.
Wow, that's just, I know. And again, not being in the room, you know, it's still all kind of hearsay. But I think there's a bigger point to be made here, Ian. And this is what I said, while we didn't know who won Georgia. I mean, technically, we still don't because there's going to be a recount, I think. But assuming Biden wins Georgia, what's so important about this state at this moment in time is if you look at, as other people have noticed and said, if you look at the electoral map, it's a sea of red, in the South, except for Georgia. And it just so happens that Atlanta, I don't say this as somebody who lives in Atlanta. Atlanta is, of course, the most important city, the biggest city, most people, biggest business, Coke, Home Depot, et cetera, Delta are all here. And the idea that there would be this, that the Democrats could capture this state for both the presidential election and one or two Senate seats, really changes, I think, national politics. And that's really the point. And that's why the Republicans are going to try everything they can to make sure that these two Senate seats stay red. If one was to flip to blue, and if assuming Biden wins the election when it's all said and done, that is a major change for the United States of America. It'd be one thing if it was North Carolina, which occasionally went back and forth. The equivalent would be Texas, obviously. Texas would be a sea change of political firestorm. Well, Georgia is second next to Texas in this part of the country in that way. So I think all eyes will be on Georgia, and it'll be interesting to see if the Republicans engage in kind of this. I just read before I got on the air with you that the Secretary of State here now, again, a Republican, is saying that Trump's suppression efforts actually hurt Republican votes in Georgia. That the way that Trump and his people ran the pre-election kind of publicity and all about COVID and all of that actually cost Republicans votes. So I thought that was very interesting that he's saying that. Maybe he's trying to shift blame. I don't know. But it's going to be the next month in Georgia is going to be very, very interesting for the entire country. Going back to McConnell for one second. So I think it's important to remember that even if the Democrats take control of the Senate by one or two votes, there are moderate Democrat senators in Midwestern and other states who may not follow the party line on this. All Republicans, when it mattered, followed the party line on McConnell. Michael Steele, the former head of the Republican Party, told me in a radio show on the air that if a Republican went against McConnell on a judicial confirmation vote, that mattered. It's one thing if they already had the votes, but that if it mattered, that person would lose all support from the Republican Party, financial support. That's how McConnell runs that ship. I don't think Joe Biden is going to run his ship that way. You know, I was thinking about this in preparation for this call. A colleague of mine at Georgia State Law School worked for both Obama and Clinton. And when he worked for Obama, he was very frustrated that they didn't take judges maybe as seriously as he would have liked. Joe Biden comes from that school. So his priorities, which I think, I'm not criticizing this, may well be climate change and racial injustice and all kinds of other things, and not judges. If that's true, and if the moderate and if some moderate Democrats don't go along, we may be stuck with the Federalist Society judiciary for a very long time.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Siegel, the Ash Family Chair, Professor of Law at Georgia State University, where he teaches federal courts and constitutional law, and he's the author of Originalism as Faith, and he just wrote the law articles, Religious Liberty as Religious Supremacy, Why Justice Alito's Federalist Society Speech Was Paranoid and Inaccurate, and Goodbye to Originalist Judges. Let's talk a little bit about Alito, because it was a strange speech, but my sense is that it's totally in keeping with the new sort of shift in the religious right in terms of their narrative. They are sort of backing away from this sort of zealous talk about, you know, anti-abortion rhetoric, etc. And they're wrapping up all of their dogma under the kind of umbrella or the rubric of religious liberty. And it also extends into foreign policy, because you have this Secretary of State, Pompeo, who is forcing this idea of religious liberty into our foreign policy. For example, in support of Christian Zionism with the State of Israel, he is now going after Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch because he inaccurately says that they support sanctioning Israel. So this is what I wonder is going on. Is this a continuation of this idea that we're talking in code? This is kind of a code for all of the kind of grab bag of the religious right, but it's dressed up in what seems like elevated and nice language of religious liberty.
Well, let's talk facts for a minute. So Justice Alito gave a speech to the Federalist Society last week where he talked about all kinds of things he shouldn't have talked about, including what he claimed was an attack on religious liberty. Let's talk facts. The Supreme Court in the last 20 years, since the Roberts Court, has upheld a huge cross on governmental property. The Supreme Court has said that if states want to fund private secular schools, they also have to fund private religious schools, a truly monumental anti-states rights, anti-textualist, anti-historical holding that is really going to cause a lot of problems for a lot of states. That was last term. Last term, the Supreme Court also held that religious schools don't have to be bound by anti-discrimination laws for the disabled and for the elderly, unlike everybody else. And I get that for priests or rabbis, but they extended it to virtually all employees of religious schools. The Little Sisters of the Poor was a symbol used by right-wing media experts to suggest an attack on religious liberty, when really all they had to do was sign a piece of paper and they would have been completely exempt from any requirement that the federal government imposes on them. Hobby Lobby, a billion-dollar for-profit corporation, was held by the court to have the right to exercise religion. Doesn't make sense. The Supreme Court has been on the religious side of every church-state case, except one, since the Roberts Court began. This is a court that is protecting the religious, and it's not religious liberty, it's religious supremacy. So what Alito was talking about was Colorado's anti-discrimination law that says if you want to sell widgets or cakes or flowers or whatever, you can't discriminate against certain groups on the basis of race and religion and sexual orientation. Alito called that law an infringement of religious liberty. That law is simply saying to religious people, when you're in your church or temple or mosque, you do what you want and the government is hands off. And I agree with that. But when you start selling widgets to the public or whatever you're selling, then you are, in fact, bound by the same laws as everybody else. But Alito, I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional because this issue is important to me. But Alito wants to give religious objectors superiority, not equality. And the idea that laws to protect gays and lesbians who have been discriminated against in this country for so long, those laws would be somehow an affront to religious liberty is insane. The Colorado baker who brought the case to the Supreme Court, he was free to worship and pray and do everything he wanted to do when it came to the exercise of religion. All Colorado was saying is when you're in a business for profit, you have to comply with the same laws everybody else does. And you don't get to carry around a 24/7 religious conscience Trump card. I use Trump card there very specifically. Alito wants that 24/7 religious conscience Trump card. There's nothing in the Constitution to support that. It's made up garbage. And his speech to the Federalist Society was really inappropriate because there is a very important case involving the Catholic Social Services in Philadelphia wants Philadelphia's money to help with foster kids, but they refuse to recognize same-sex couples as legally married. They claim, this is incredible, Ian, they claim they have a right to the money even though they're not willing to live up to the expectations in the contract. This is not a case like the baker where state law is making them do something. Catholic Social Services in Philadelphia wants money from the government but doesn't want to abide by the conditions in that contract, which are nothing more or less than don't discriminate against gays and lesbians. We're in a crazy world of religious supremacy, not religious equality, and here's Alito complaining about the attacks on religion. My piece today makes the point that what's being attacked is the separation of church and state. That wall is being lowered by this Supreme Court every single term. And the gall that he has to suggest that's not happening is it's almost too much to take for someone whose life and career requires him to follow the court. Could not be more wrong and more hypocritical. Sorry for that rant.
No worries. but surely it's a better to dress up bigotry, which is what it really comes down to, in this lofty language of religious liberty. And, there's also this kind of persecution complex that's going on now with the religious right, you know, that they're all aboard Trump's lies that he won the elections, that it's been stolen by these kind of satanic leftists.
There's a story behind that. It takes a few minutes to explain, but I think it's a very important story, if you don't mind, because when we talk about evangelicals in the Supreme Court, what we normally used to talk about was how in 1977, I think it was, it may have been 76, Jerry Falwell was asked about abortion, and he said, I don't care. I mean, you know, he had no strong opinions about it. Then Ed Meese and others in the Reagan campaign reached out to the evangelicals and said, come into our fold, vote with us, make abortion an issue, and that will give Robertson and Falwell and Jimmy Swaggart, all these people, all kinds of money and power. That story is familiar. The story that's not familiar goes directly to what you're talking about, which is, and Sarah Posner wrote a book called Unholy, and I strongly recommend you have her on your show. She just published a book about this. In 2012, after Obama one second time, evangelicals started to change their focus, like you mentioned earlier, from abortion to this idea that same-sex marriage and rights for gays and lesbians somehow offends their religious freedom. And they started making ties. Sarah Posner documents all this with evidence, with Putin and other totalitarian leaders around the world. So in 2013, Russia passes the most draconian anti-gay and lesbian law in history, and our evangelicals latched onto them, and that's the beginning of the Putin-Trump evangelical alliance. And that triangle right there of not just Putin but other right-wing leaders in other countries, that it's that triangle that seized power in America, which is why Trump and Nita Bush did this. Trump filled his Health and Human Services agency, which is the agency that deals with issues like health and abortion, with evangelicals. You know, all the top people, most of them were evangelicals. And this is a real problem for America because their importance to our political system, their impact on our lives is far disproportionate to their numbers. Really disproportionate.
But well, you have to add to that. Add to that. That in 2006, Opus Dei set up an office in Moscow, And Opus Dei now works with the reactionary Orthodox Church, which is all in with Putin. And there is this kind of thread there, because the person who's choosing all of these federal judges, the 200 that they've seated under Trump, is Leonard Leo, who's a member of Opus Dei. And he's got six now of the conservative judges, and the last one being Amy Coney Barrett, on this court. Now, I don't know whether all of those six are Opus Dei, and there have been rumors, of course, that Bill Barr is Opus Dei, although Opus Dei, which is a secretive organization, sent out a press release a little while back saying he wasn't a member, which sort of doesn't really make a lot of sense given their secrecy. But still, isn't that what we're talking about? You know, you're talking about the evangelicals, but isn't this a 1-2 punch? Because you've got this arch-conservative reactionary strain of Catholicism founded by a Spanish fascist as, you know, a 1-2 punch with the religious right.
Well, let me be clear, Ian, about some of that and the Supreme Court. I'll defer to your knowledge about Opus Dei, but I don't think Justice Roberts, Justice Alito, Justice Thomas, I'm probably not. I don't think it's that the justices are Opus Dei. I think it's that the justices are handpicked, were all six, were, as you write about this, handpicked by Leonard Leo to lower the wall of church and state across the board. And that's what they've done. And so retired Judge Richard Posner, who some of your listeners might know, and I wrote a piece in the New York Times years ago talking about Scalia's theocratic vision, that Justice Scalia really had no issue with America becoming more or less a theocracy. But he is tame compared to Justice Barrett, and he is tame compared to Justice Alito, because Scalia, on one side of the equation, didn't believe in a strong free exercise clause. In other words, we have two clauses, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. One prevents government from giving too much to religion, and one prevents government from, you know, punishing religion. Scalia had no use for the Establishment Clause at all. But he also didn't have much use for the Free Exercise Clause, and he wrote the major Supreme Court decision saying that religious people don't have a right to be exempt from laws that everyone else, you know, have to follow. Barrett and Alito are to Scalia's right on that issue. And this is a court that asked for the case that Scalia wrote, whether it should be overturned or not, this term. So whether it's whatever sect we're talking about, we have Supreme Court justices, six of them at least, six, who are committed to lowering the wall of separation of church and state to a very dangerous degree. And then, you know, in the Trump administration, there was no separation. He just brought in evangelicals to run the country, or people like Bill Barr, who was deeply religious. And you and I have talked before. Bill Barr gave Attorney General of the United States gave a public speech at Notre Dame where he said, if you don't have faith, you have no ethics. There is no ethic. There are no ethics separate from faith. He has said that now on several occasions. That is so deeply insulting to people who are agnostic or even atheists, who think, you know, I'm agnostic, Ian. I think I'm a person of ethics. I try to do the right thing. It's not because I believe in God. It's because I try to do the right thing. But they don't see it that way. They see the world, and Alito sees the world in two camps, good and evil. And that's a very dangerous quality for anybody, much less life-tenured Supreme Court justices. I was just arguing on Twitter with a law professor named Jonathan Adler, who keeps saying that the nomination and confirmation battles over the years have been kind of a tie between the bad stuff the Republicans did and the bad stuff the Democrats did. And he's so wrong. But even if he wasn't, the point is they won. They have six Federalist Society judges, as you pointed out, and hundreds of Federalist Society judges in the lower courts. I hope Joe Biden makes this a priority. I don't know if he will. It's not his style. And let's not forget, the only reason we have Clarence Thomas today, the only reason, is because Joe Biden would not let two women testify to the same type of things that Anita Hill testified to at her hearing. They were in Washington, D.C., ready to testify, and he wouldn't let them. Now, people make mistakes. No one's perfect. That was a huge mistake by Joe Biden. I don't know how important judges are going to be to him. I really don't, Ian. And that That could potentially be a big problem, even if Democrats have the Senate, which I think is unlikely. Sorry for that pessimistic outlook. But
well, no, I'm glad we had the conversation, because I think this has to be the issue that's brought up. And the fact that Biden's Catholic may actually be an advantage in pointing out the extraordinary power of this one man, Leonard Leo, to shape our judiciary. It just is so extraordinary that one man has been able to do this. And this is something that definitely has to be looked into. And I thank you for joining us, Eric Segal.
No question. No, I was just going to say, Joe Biden is a Catholic in the Anthony Kennedy mode of Catholicism. You know, I want to say a liberal Catholic. It's not what I mean. But, you know, Anthony Kennedy was Catholic.
Yeah.
Not doctrinaire. Thank you. And that's right. That's right. Thank you. No, I was just going to say, I just hope that Joe Biden delegates to someone like Leonard Leo on the left a full-time job to pick judges. That's what Trump did. He delegated to Leo full-time and began picking judges. Because the president shouldn't do that anyway, right? We want the president worried about climate change and other things. I hope Biden picks someone who is as ambitious and as centered on judges as Leonard Leo has been for the last 15 years.
Well, Eric Segal, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Segal, who's the Ash Family Chair, Professor of Law at Georgia State University, where he teaches federal courts and constitutional law. He's the author of Originalism as Faith, and he just wrote the law articles Religious Liberty as Religious Supremacy, Why Justice Alito's Federalist Society Speech Was Paranoid and Inaccurate, and Goodbye to Originalist Judges. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into Trump's plan to pull U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, Iraq, and Somalia and bomb the Iranian nuclear site at Natanz, which appear to be spiteful and vindictive acts designed to frustrate Biden and tie his hands in dealing with the region.
نازنین نازداری با موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی و چند.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who's the Provost Distinguished Professor in the Security Studies Program within Georgetown University Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul and served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. And she's the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and In Their Own Words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba. And she speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what do you make of the president's plans to pull out of Afghanistan, but not just Afghanistan, Iraq and Somalia? And apparently he's pretty determined to do this. And he's more or less he's overridden his aides. And of course, we could also discuss that last Thursday, apparently he asked for options to strike the Natanz site inside Iran, their nuclear site. So let's begin with Afghanistan, which is your specialty. So what does that mean, pulling out half of the relatively small number of U.S. forces that are there already?
From my point of view, I don't think the most important thing is the troops. I mean, the troops right now are really in such small number that they're largely in a train in support mode. Probably the most important thing that U.S. forces are giving the Afghans, and that's air support, not so much ground support. So from my point of view, the most disturbing thing has really been the decrease in the money that this government has given Afghanistan. And, you know, this is something that really needs to be understood. The U.S. government, as the head international actor in Afghanistan, is a part of its massive effort to build this Afghan state, built a state that has been unprecedented in its size. And it doesn't have its own resources to fund that enormous state. And that means that when the last soldier is gone, I think the U.S. Congress is going to be ever more unwilling to keep writing the check. The size of the check, for example, the U.S. cut the humanitarian assistance to Afghanistan by half in the last funding cycle. And then that's going to have a deleterious effect with respect to our allies. The EU is the second largest contributor. When we pull out, they will also be gone. And again, it will be less willing to continue helping Afghanistan pay its bills. And when that last check comes, I don't see the Afghan state being able to pay its security forces. And then it's simply a question of time, how soon the country devolves into civil war, which, of course, the Pakistanis will be greatly anticipating with some enthusiasm.
Well, already the Afghan military apparently are under stress. They're besieged in the south and in the north. Apparently morale is very low among the Afghan security forces. And this uncertain situation has led a lot of local political leaders in Afghanistan to make deals with the Taliban, who are advancing.
Yeah, well, this has also been an ongoing problem. Again, the United States insisted upon having this. At the time, there was something in the order of little shy of 400,000 persons in the ANDSF. That was never sustainable. They were basically, you know, I'm not even joking, they were bringing opium-addled people and trying to teach them to shoot straight. My experiences at Kabul Military Training Center and other places was pretty eye-opening. And essentially, the U.S. had to settle upon a smaller number, but the number itself was never sustainable. The morale has always been low. The casualties have always been high. The Afghan government has tried to protect that actual number for any number of reasons. So the other thing that this administration has done, and I think it will be very difficult for the incoming Biden administration to roll back, is that in Trump's zeal to get out of Afghanistan, which was something that he had promised on the campaign trail, he has gone over backwards to accommodate the Taliban. He's essentially handing the Afghans back to the Pakistanis. And the Taliban have been pretty inflexible. He is telling the American people that this was going to be a conditions base, with all of that verbiage has been complete rubbish. The peace process itself is not even a peace process. And so what you actually have happening on the ground in Afghanistan is a negotiation on the one hand between the Taliban, who do not recognize the legitimacy of the current Afghan government, and of course the Afghan government, which correctly feels that it has paid the price for its own freedom, and it can't understand why the Americans are so anxious to hand the country back to the Taliban. That's actually what's happening with regards to this alleged peace process. There's no negotiation of peace. The Taliban have insisted, for example, that thousands of their murderous cadres be released. The U.S. government put pressure on the Afghan government to do that. Basically, Pompeo said, if you don't let these Taliban prisoners go, we're not going to give you money. So the Afghan government, at the point of the checkbook, was forced to let these murderers out, and they continue to commit outrageous atrocities, like, for example, the attack at American University Kabul a few weeks ago. So this is, I think, been the most despicable thing that Trump has done in the area that I follow.
But being a rentier state as Afghanistan is, and has mm-hmm. always been, as far as I can tell, at least for the last decades, right?
Well, no, actually, it's been a rentier state since it essentially came into the international system. It was essentially a carcass over which Russia and the British Empire fought in the 19th century. Here's a funny story. you know, if you look at Afghanistan, it kind of looks like a thumb, right, with that Wakhan corridor jutting out in the northeast. Basically, Russia and the British Empire made King Abdurrahman in the late 19th century, except that because it's a part of Afghanistan, because that would be the little piece of land that kept the British Empire and Russia from sharing a border. And this was also the poor fellow that had to accept the Durand Line. So when Afghanistan basically told the Brits to get out circa 1920, the Brits said, fine, but we're taking our money with us. And that's when Afghanistan began the slow commitment to becoming a Russian, then Soviet client state. But even at the height of the government that the Soviets built, it was not so massive. Afghanistan could still pay about 70%. The Russians were still paying about 30% of the recurring costs of running that government. The government that the United States built, the Afghan government cannot pay, I mean, it virtually can pay no part of the recurring costs. So it's always been a rentier state, but the United States, this has largely been driven by pork politics, right? We wanted to put the Afghans on American weapon systems. We wanted to build a giant army because we have a giant army. I mean, there a lot of the decisions that were made were really driven by things that politicians could sell to the American taxpayer, right? We've got all these contractors pay Americans. The contractors are bearing the brunt, not soldiers. You know, these were made, and we talk a lot about the corruption in the Afghan government, but a lot of that corruption was actually started by the United States government. And SIGAR, which is this watchdog organization, you know, every week I get emails where they're identifying various corrupt outrages, not done by the Afghans, but done by the Americans in Afghanistan. And there's never any consequences, right? SIGAR finds them. They're never prosecuted. They can continue getting government contracts despite being identified by SIGAR. So this is not a disaster of Trump's making, right? This has been a systematic, every year accruing, if you will, a defeat paid for on the installment plan. But what Trump has done, he's made a very difficult puzzle that was always going to be difficult to solve, impossible to solve for the incoming president. He's essentially began a game of chicken by removing his steering wheel and will then be giving this vehicle to Biden to drive. Okay. And he's done that also with the Iran deal, right? Mm-hmm. Despite all of the odds, Iran evidenced a willingness to resume negotiations with the incoming president. And, you know, as you said in your opening statement, Trump wants to bomb Iran because that would, again, make any kind of reopening to the Iranians impossible. So this is, I mean, he's just basically, it is the geopolitical equivalent of taking all the keys off the keyboards and removing all the toilet seats from the toilets. I mean, it's just amazing. But that's the outgoing president for you.
Well, it's geopolitical delinquency, really. And
yeah,
again,
exactly. Well, that's what I meant by removing the keys from the keyboard. Right. It's the kinds of shenanigans that,
Well, he doesn't care about anybody.
No, he cares about no one.
And again, I'm speaking.
Well, that's not true. He does care about 2024.
That's right? True.
This is all about him saying, "And on my last days out, you know, televangelicals, you know, I tied his hands on Iran because Iran is the biggest foe of Israel, and we all know that you know you need Israel for Jesus to come back and condemn the Jews to hell." I mean, it is right. That's a televangelical logic on Israel. It's nothing to do with Israel's own interests. It's everything to do with him furthering his alliance with the Talibangelicals, which I will call them that without apology.
And again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, who's the Provost Distinguished Professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul and served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center and is the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and In Their Own Words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba, and she speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi. Now, we talked about it, the Afghanistan as a kind of basket case, a perennial one, a rentier state, but also the Afghan military that we've tried to stand up, and you mentioned that they just, you know, got a bunch of opium-addled kids from the country and put a gun in their hand and tried to get them to shoot straight. So, but it's even worse, isn't it? I mean, I read somewhere the top person, I guess maybe it was the defense minister, or at least the head of the military, apparently, he looked through a bunch of catalogs on what kind of camo the army should wear, and he picked out one that he liked, which is kind of a jungle camo for a desert country. I mean, is that true?
No, I don't believe that the onus of this falls directly on him. The United States, there's even more absurdity about it. This camo was made in the United States, right, when there are far cheaper, like, for example, India is an important partner. India could have made that camo. But yeah, no, when I was in Afghanistan last year, I did see that camo. It was stunning. It's stunningly appropriate. But, you know, the United States Army did this, too. When my brothers deployed to Iraq, they were deployed in 2002. They were one of the guard units that were deployed. They were not deployed with desert camo. They were deployed with jungle camo. And my brother, both of them were sergeants. They're not officers. At the time, my older brother, who has a dark sense of humor somewhat akin to my own, he says, I guess I shall just organize my men so that we resemble an oasis. Right? So yes, it's absurd, but it's even more absurd that the United States Army, in a war that was completely voluntary and also illegal, deployed its own soldiers with jungle camo to Iraq. And in fact, my brother's vehicles, had even been sent to Fort Bragg to be repainted. And guess what they repainted them as for their deployment to Iraq? Jungle camo. But you know, here's the other thing. Afghanistan isn't really desert either, right? It actually has a really complicated terrain, which is why, you know, a more digital camo might be more appropriate. It depends on where you are. You know, if you're up in Kunar and Assadabad in the winter, it's covered in snow. If you're there in the spring and summer, it's very verdant. It's forested mountains. So the idea of Afghanistan itself being one terrain is also not accurate, because much of Afghanistan is very verdant. Remember, there's the beautiful poppy fields, which, you know, also another point of irony in American history. You know, we built the Helmand River Valley system. It was modeled after the Tennessee, the TVA, the Tennessee Valley. Yeah. So that, the TVA became the model for the Helmand Valley River system, which is in turn what makes Helmand so productive with respect to poppy. But I think there are a lot of problems with Afghanistan. I mean, the other thing that the Americans did not do, and again, Trump didn't make this problem, but he hasn't, you know, like everyone else, there's really been nothing to do to ameliorate it. You know, it's difficult to train an army when everyone's illiterate, right? This is probably not something that people really appreciate. I mean, how do you teach someone to do logistics and to even do something like keep track of supplies when they are utterly illiterate? What the Russians did, actually, to get around this, they sent many of the military officers, as well as enlisted, to Russia to learn, to teach them to read and to write and to do math. They trained tens of thousands of people. And so, ironically, some of the most competent people that the West has interacted with in Afghanistan have been those Soviet-trained individuals, right? So, you know, we can, again, put the onus upon the Afghans, but I would put the onus on the Americans. You know, the Americans tried to do this in six-month intervals over the last 20 years. And we had a really similarly desultory approach to training the police. You know, what we were trying to do was it was essentially hose off the corruption from them and put them right back into the corrupt system. And, you know, and to give you another example of the corruption that we helped to foster, one of the things that the Taliban did early on that garnered Afghan respect was that they had returned all of the young boys that the warlords had captured and were keeping as catamites, which I suppose is the nicest word for what they were doing. Under the U.S. government, if you look at some of the military bases, everything that we had on those bases were essentially rented from what we would call Afghan strongmen if they were working with us. And we were paying these men enormous sums of money, and we were enabling them to keep ever more young boys as sex slaves. And when soldiers and police from the United States and other countries reported this, they were basically told, mind your own business. You may recall this. I think you even reported on it several years ago. We had a senior Army enlisted fellow who shot an Afghan counterpart who was raping a young boy, and he was prosecuted for doing that. He was prosecuted that, here.
Just in closing, we're running out of time, Christine Fair, but I just wanted to touch on the fact that there are still 7,000 NATO and allied troops, Australians among them, are there in Afghanistan training Afghan government forces. Will they be forced to withdraw as well, or will they be left holding the bag?
Well, I don't think either will happen. What will happen when we withdraw is that they will withdraw. Now, those numbers have always been misleading, right? So one of the problems, Australia aside, Australia is really quite different from the other NATO contributors. You know, they always had these things called caveats. So, like, for example, the German caveats were notorious because the Germans thought they were in Afghanistan as peacekeepers. They weren't allowed to fire on the Taliban unless the Taliban initiated fire. And I remember actually traveling in a German APC in Mazar as the Taliban went speeding by. And, you know, as an American, I grew up on the Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner cartoons. And it just reminded me of that, you know, as long as Wile E. Coyote doesn't take, the piss out of the Roadrunner, everything is peaceful. But that was pretty surreal to see. And the Germans had pretty dark senses of humor about it. Their bases were constantly being subjected by Taliban artillery and so forth. So the numbers have never been what the numbers would suggest, because each of the countries contributing troops had a very strict set of parameters under which they could actually engage in the use of force. So the numbers have never really been that important. In fact, I remember, you know, seeing a number of occasions when people were doing planning to see what kind of forces were available, they had these programmed tools that would overlay where in the country these different caveats were employed to give you an actual sense of what kind of end strength you had on the ground. But, yeah, when we leave, there is no doubt that the other contributors will also leave. And then this is going to trigger, in each of those countries, the very real question of, if we don't have boots on the ground, why are we writing the check, right? And so in some sense, having boots on the ground is a force function for those parliaments to continue the responsibility of funding this massive government in which they were all complicit in building, right? Mm-hmm. So from my point of view, what they do on the ground, what kind of missions they're doing, is less important than the checks. Because at the end of the day, we need to stabilize Afghanistan so that it can fight off the Taliban, fight off whatever neo-Taliban the Pakistanis are ginning up. But we also have to, over the long term, begin this process of right-sizing the Afghan government, right? We have never tried to right-size the Afghan government so that it's sustainable. And then we have this other issue of the Chinese, right? There are a lot of resources in Afghanistan. We can't get them out of the ground and into the market so that Afghanistan can pay for itself. And the question lingers, will the Chinese step in and play this role of resource extraction? And, you know, I think there are a lot of Americans who, while they might be very wary of China overall, are hoping that that answer is yes, right? But then that also leaves some of our important regional allies in the lurch. Like, for example, India would be very wary of Afghanistan filling this funding vacuum, right, and trying to make Afghanistan a part of its Belt and Road Initiative. So, you know, I'm an enormous critic of President Trump, but this, the Afghan puzzle really is a puzzle from hell, right? Obama didn't do it right. George W. in many ways built all of the mistakes that he would then pass on to the subsequent administrations that followed his own.
And we have what we have. And I thank you very much for joining us here today, Christine Fair.
Thank you so much. Have a great day, Ian.
You too. And again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, who is the Provost Distinguished Professor in the Security Studies Program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul and served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center and is the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and In Their Own Words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba, and she speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the reaction at Stanford University to Trump's new medical advisor Scott Atlas's call for Trump supporters to rise up against Michigan Governor Whitmer, who was recently threatened with kidnapping and murder by pro-Trump militia members.
Empire, the newborn of a hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flocks from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is William Gould, a Stanford Law professor specializing in labor and discrimination law, who previously served as chairman of the National Labor Relations Board. His most recent book is Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Gould.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And Stanford is in the spotlight now because of Scott Atlas, the radiologist at the Hoover Institution, who now has President Trump's ear on all matters involving the pandemic and COVID-19, after Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx and others have been marginalized, if not purged. And he made the most amazing statement a couple of days ago in response to Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan instituting some lockdown restrictions to fight the pandemic. He urged Trump's followers to rise up against these restrictions, in effect inciting rebellion or inciting violence against a governor who had already been threatened with kidnapping and death. So it's an extraordinary thing. Now, what do you think of the response from Stanford? It seems the official response was pretty lukewarm, if not insipid. There's no condemnation of what he said.
Yes, the Stanford approach was simply to disassociate themselves with Dr. Atlas, but it seemed to me that, and many here, that there should have been a flat-out condemnation of what Dr. Atlas said, because it was not only a call to violence, it was, it seems to me, something that is really inconsistent with the role of a public health official.
So is there anything going on in the campus with the, I believe the students are forming a movement to either have him removed from the university or even the Hoover Institution itself. What's happening with that?
Well, there are a number of students. There have been articles in the Stanford Daily about this, expressing widespread displeasure with the cautious, tepid way in which the university has responded. And there's been a great deal of focus, again, as there was in the 1980s, upon the role of the Hoover Institute here, which Dr. Atlas is a part of, which is really an ideological institution designed to promote a particular far-right point of view, and fundamentally inconsistent with the idea of academic inquiry and academic research.
So back, though, in September, 100 Stanford faculty members condemned Scott Atlas and the Hoover Institution when he started to offer up his herd immunity policy, which dovetails perfectly with President Trump's incompetence and negligence, because essentially what Scott Atlas is advocating is that that the government does nothing and you just let this pandemic run its course until God knows how many Americans die. So that's what he's offering up. And there was a very stern open letter written by members of the Stanford University School of Medicine faculty and others. And I think actually Atlas, who is not a specialist in microbiology, immunology, or any of the disciplines associated with COVID-19, he's a neuroradiologist. He apparently, I think he sued after that letter, but that's gone nowhere, hasn't it?
So far as I'm aware, it's gone nowhere. It's very difficult for anyone who has any kind of public exposure to sue for defamation, as he, I think, did, unless it's done with malicious disregard for the truth. And the statement is quite to the contrary on the other side of the coin. So that has little chance. But we remain hopeful that the university might reconsider its relationship with Hoover. It doesn't do much for our academic reputation, although I'm told that financially it's of some significance to the university itself because of the great inflow of money from large corporations and institutions that support the Trump point of view on a variety of issues.
So that's so you're saying that the fact that it gets a lot of right-wing money is a kind of an insurance policy it has. But surely Stanford itself is pretty well endowed, isn't it?
It is, but Stanford has always been very reticent to deal with Hoover in anything other than a cautious, very cautious manner. And I think this is, well, Stanford has very good endowments. All universities welcome contributions and financial assistance. And I'm afraid that Hoover provides a good deal of it and a great connection between universities and the world of those who can give substantially. So I think there's been a caution. You know, this is not the first time we've been through this in the 1980s. With the Reagan administration, the Hoover Institute was sent many people to Washington at that time who basically were doing the bidding of a right-wing ideological line. Again, much to the embarrassment of much of the academic community here at Stanford.
Well, just in closing, William Gould, given the sort of temerity of Stanford's hierarchy, I don't know exactly whose responsibility is it, whether it's the dean's or the president of the university, to take a more forceful stand against the outrages of Scott Atlas, not just risking the lives of millions of Americans with herd immunity, but inciting violence against the governor of Michigan, and prior to that, going on Russian television, RT, spouting the same kind of propaganda that Russia's spouting to divide and confuse Americans. The new task force that Joe Biden has announced for his coronavirus task force includes two Stanford alums, Atul Gawande and Lois Pace. They've been appointed to the 13-person board. So that's something that Stanford should be celebrating and promoting, at the very least, if they're being cowardly about their handling of Scott Atlas.
Yes. Oh, yes. I think that many people at Stanford have been quite active in public service, I amongst them. And Stanford is quite properly proud of such individuals. But the whole question of the functioning of Hoover, its involvement in right-wing television, right-wing radio, and now with the Trump administration, is not something that leaves many, if not most of us, very much at ease with.
Well, William Guild, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Surely.
And again, I've been speaking with William Guild, who's a Stanford law professor specializing in labor and discrimination law, who previously served as chairman of the National Labor Relations Board. And his most recent book is Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with the man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared. One more light goes on.